there rubbing her hair while she played some kind of game on the tablet, and I looked out across the yard. It looked so normal. After a bit, she asked,
"You all right?"
"Yeah, kiddo, I'm good. Just wanted to hang out with you for a bit. Feels like I haven't seen you in forever." "Yeah, you're gone a lot. Is everything okay?" "So long as we're together, it is, don't you think?" Mel came out on the porch and smiled when she saw me sitting there with Taylor. "Well, look at you two. You want some lunch?" "I'd love some, if you two will eat with me." "Leanne and Ashley are at the table," Mel said. "Well, come on, kiddo, let's eat," I said to Taylor. We went in and had lunch as a family. Mel had made a black bean soup from some of the freeze-dried stuff we had. Black beans, onion, green pepper, carrots, and some spices of some kind. A simple dish, but it was damn good. I talked with the girls, told jokes, and tried to pretend that it was any normal day, and they had just come home from school. When we finished lunch, the girls cleaned the table off and worked together to wash the dishes. I went into the living room and sat on the couch. Mel brought me a glass of tea, and we sat for a while, just sitting. It didn't last long, though. Meathead started barking, and a knock on the door soon followed. Thad was at the door, with his big smile when I opened it. "What smells so good?" he said. "Black bean soup. You want some?" Mel asked. Thad smiled and patted his belly. "I don't turn down good groceries, ma'am," he said. "I don't know how good it is, but I'll get you a bowl." "Don't let her fool you. It is good," I said, as I waved him in. "Well, thank you, Miss Mel. Can you put it in a cup so I can take it with? We need to go."
"Sure,"
she said.
"What's up?" I asked.
"Sarge wants to get this done," Thad said. Mel walked up with one of those oversized coffee cup bowl things and handed it to Thad.
"Get what done?"
I told her. "We're gonna take care of that guy who shot Leanne. Don't wait up, okay?" Mel nodded and said,
"Good. Just be careful."
I kissed her and followed Thad out. When we got to Reggie's, he, Danny, Jeff, and Sarge's guys were waiting.
"Now that you're all here, let's get down to business," Sarge said. "I know you fellas have had a couple of scrapes up to this point, but things are about to go to a whole new level. And if any of you want out, just say the word. No one will think any less of you."
"No disrespect meant, but we don't need the speech," Danny said. I'd known him for a long time, but his determination there showed a different side of him.
"All righty then. Ted, Mike, and Reggie are going to hit the rest of these douchebags at their place and take them out. The rest of us are going to take out this trash. Leave them where their DHS buddies are sure to find them," Sarge said.
"How are we going to do that?" I asked.
"I figured we'd take them down toward the range and leave them in the road. That way their patrols would find them," Sarge said.
"How are we going to take them out? If we just shoot at them, they'll be all over us," Reggie said.
Sarge looked over at Reggie.
"It's a good question. It shows you're thinking. Mike and Ted are going to use suppressed weapons when they hit those guys. You'll be outside to take out any runners."
Reggie stood up from the table.
"I can take care of myself. I can go in there with them."
"I'm not saying you can't, but this is how this kind of operation is done. Someone has to be outside to take out anyone who gets past the first team. These guys have experience in this business. When was the last time you kicked in a door?"
"Since never. I got you," Reggie said.
"What about us?" I said.
"I'm coming along with you guys. We'll get the prisoners tied up and load them into my buggy. Danny, I want you to drive it. Morgan, you and Thad ride ATVs, one in front and one behind. Got it?"
"What about me?" Jeff asked.
Sarge said, "How good are you with that peasant rifle?"
Jeff didn't blink.
"This isn't your average peasant rifle."
"I bet it ain't. You're with us," Sarge said as he turned away.
"Reggie, we need some rags. You got any?"
Reggie nodded and headed for the house. Sarge went to the door on the barn and opened it.
"Thad, Morgan, come in here and help me take these guys down."
We loaded the militiamen into the hyena. Ted was finished with Jeff's instructions, and Sarge called for everyone to load up. Reggie got into the rear third seat of the buggy. Mike and Ted were talking, while Thad and I got on our ATVs. Danny climbed in behind the wheel of the Hyena, and Sarge gave a couple of last-minute orders to Mike and Ted. They were to take up a position south of where we were going to drop the four men and wait for us. Mike nodded his head and drove away in the fading light of evening. We took a trail out the back of the neighborhood, with me in the lead. Mike followed along for a while, until he got to the point where he would break off and head for their target. Since I was out front, I didn't see them break off the trail, but the two clicks in the headset Sarge had given me, followed by a one-click reply from Sarge, told me they were leaving us. We still had a ways to go to get to the spot we had decided on. Mike stopped on the thick edge of a swamp. The three of them took a few minutes to cover the buggy with a camo net before taking a knee and going over the plan one last time. Ted scratched out a rough layout of the little clump of trailers, detailing how he and Mike would enter, go through them one at a time, and then exit the area. He stuck a stick in the soft dirt to show where Reggie was to position himself and gave him instructions on who to engage and how to engage them. Women were off the list, unless they were armed and posed an immediate threat. Any women he and Mike encountered would not be harmed unless they had to, and they hoped not to find any. When the instructions were done, Mike handed Reggie a night vision monocular, helped him get it on, and showed him how to use it. Then Mike handed him one of the captured MP5s. He said, "I put an IR laser in this. Here's the switch." Mike turned the weapon on its side to show him. "It'll show up nice and bright in the goggle, but no one else will be able to see it. You've got your radio. If you see anyone coming, let us know. If you see anyone running, take them out. Got it?" Reggie nodded, and Ted said, "When we're in position, we'll let you know. You reply with one key of the mic, then we'll move in. You ready for this?" Reggie nodded his head and turned to move off into the darkness. Mike and Ted were immediately on the move, heading the opposite direction from Reggie's line of travel. Reggie moved carefully through the woods, like he would if he was deer hunting. He felt like he was moving too slow, but he knew that going quickly and being quiet didn't go together, and he forced himself to take his time. He could hear voices coming from the clump of trailers, and he knew if he made any noise, they might hear him too. It was still early, but without electric lights, most people went to bed soon after the sun set. He made it to his assigned position, and once there, he understood why the guys had chosen it. It was the logical escape route from the trailers, almost a funnel out of the place. Mike and Ted slipped silently around the edge of the group of trailers. Occasionally, they caught glimpses of a fire burning out in the center of the park, but they couldn't tell if anyone was out there. The occasional voice drifted through the trees, but overall it was quiet. They made it to the corner of the first trailer, where they would start the clearing operation, and took up a prone position behind a long dead pine tree. Ted keyed his mic. "In position. Gonna wait a bit." A single click answered him. Chapter 37. As we approached Highway 445 on the trail, I slowed to see if there was anyone around. Stopping a good 50 yards off the road, I called back to Sarge to tell him we had arrived, and I was taking a look. He told me to be careful, and I eased up to the edge of the forest to take a look. I knelt down and listened to the black night, looking both ways, then listened again. Not hearing anything, I called back and told them it was clear and to come up, then climbed back up on the Polaris to wait for them. It didn't take long for them to show up. Sarge waved me forward and I quickly crossed the road, pushing the Polaris wide open so as to not expose myself for long. The Hyena and Thad both crossed without incident, and we were soon heading down an old power line right-of-way. Ted looked at his watch, then up at the sky. It was black as pitch. He tapped Mike on the shoulder and pointed toward the house. Mike nodded, and the two men stood up. Ted keyed the mic and said, "Moving." A single click answered him.
Ted stepped up to the first trailer and gripped the knob. Mike nodded at him, and he slowly turned it. It wasn't locked, and they went in. Ted went left, and Mike went right. Ted moved down a small hall. The first door he came to was a bathroom, and he quickly pushed the door shut as the smell coming out of it assaulted his nose. The second door was a bedroom. There was a small bed there, with a body lying under some blankets. From the size of the figure and the rest of the room's contents, he concluded it was a child, a little girl. He quietly shut the door and moved to the last room. Ted looked in and saw a form on the bed, a woman. He shut the door and went back to the front door. They moved on to the next trailer, and this one had lights on inside. Mike gripped the knob, looked back at Ted, got the nod, and opened the door with a jerk. The door entered into the living room, and the kitchen was visible off to the right. Sitting in a recliner was an older man, hunched over a TV tray, eating something. When the door opened, he looked up, but never made a sound. A 230 grain, 45 cal ball from Ted's pistol crashed into his forehead, snapping his head back and splattering gore all over the wall. The suppressor on the pistol made a dull coughing noise and no more. The only other person they found was an old woman, still asleep in the back bedroom. They left as they found her. After crossing the road, we made our way through the thick sand under the power lines. We had to pull off the right-of-way when it turned to the west, crossing over the highway. And the many forest trails became our new route. I had been on many of them during hunting season, or just riding around the woods, and knew which ones to take to keep heading in our intended direction of travel. We wound our way along for some time. Then Sarge called for a halt. I stopped, and he pulled up to me. He had a map out, lying in his lap. Thad rolled up behind him and walked over to us. "I don't want to get any closer, or close enough. They'll find him here." Sarge paused and said to Thad, "You and Morgan ease out to the road and see if anyone's out there. Take a minute and look and listen. We ain't in a hurry." We moved off toward the road, making our way through the small sand pines and thick sand. It reminded me of my walk through the forest north of there to get home. The same green gloom filled my goggles as it had then. We stayed just inside the tree line, looking and listening for several minutes, not seeing or hearing anything. Finally, Thad made a noise, and I looked over in his direction. He jutted a thumb over his shoulder, and I stood, half-crouched, and backed away from the road. Danny, Jeff, and Sarge had the four men outstanding in a line. "See anything?" Sarge asked. "Nope. Looks clear," I said. "Let's get this done, then," Sarge said, then reached into the passenger floorboard of his buggy, took something large and flat, and tucked it under his arm. "All right, ladies. Hands on the shoulders of the men in front of you. Give me any shit, and you'll regret it." To emphasize his point, he drew his taser, pulled the cartridge off the end, and hit the trigger. The loud snapping and popping made the men jump, and they immediately raised their arms, groping at the air, looking like zombies in a bad B-movie. When they were all lined up, we started out into the brush again. When the four men felt the road under their feet, they were visibly relieved. Sarge turned and looked at us, kind of expectantly. I just looked back at him. Not getting the reaction he was expecting, he held his arm out and waved it at the four men. "Well, I can't do it. Has to be one of you," Sarge said. I wanted to ask why. I don't know if it was genuine curiosity or a subconscious stalling tactic on my part, but I didn't get the chance. A loud pop and a flash of light caught me by surprise from my right. I ducked and looked just in time to see Goat fall back onto the pavement. Jeff was standing in front of the falling man, his suppressed Glock in his right hand. The other three men jumped at the shot, and Jeff shot Marv next. Avery and Ned started to run blindly down the road into the night. Avery tripped and fell, and it took two shots for Ned to go down. Jed walked toward the fat man as he rolled around trying to get up. Jeff shot him in the top of his head, and he fell over. Continuing past him to where Ned lay, He fired a round into his head as well. Jeff calmly changed the mag in his pistol before reholstering it in the shoulder rig under his coat. Seeing everyone looking at him, he said, "What?" He nodded at me, and I knew my speech earlier had hit home. Sarge said, "You're a weird little fucker, aren't you?"
"Yeah, but in a good way,"
Jeff said. Sarge smiled and shook his head.
"All right, drag them all to one spot."
We worked together to drag the bodies together. Sarge wanted them all in a sitting position, leaning on one another with their legs out like an X. Once they were all positioned, Sarge took out what was tucked under his arm. It was a big piece of cardboard. He unfolded it and painted in large letters it read, "Looters and murderers working for the DHS. We didn't linger once the job was done. No high fives or shit talking. It was a quiet and somber walk back to our rides.
"Where are all these guys?"
"There were more here earlier," Ted whispered to Mike as he shut the door to the trailer.
"I don't know. Where's that fire we saw on the way in?"
Ted shrugged, then pointed around the corner. Mike nodded, and they started around the small trailer. As soon as they rounded the corner, they found the rest of them. They were sitting around the fire pit. One of them was standing and looking in their direction. Mike raised his pistol and fired at the standing man. Two rounds and he was down. The other three scrambled for their weapons. Mike engaged a second as Ted drew down on the other two targets. After a moment of rapid firing, they changed the magazines in their pistols. There was one trailer left, and they quickly searched it. There was nothing inside except a mess. The place was filthy. The two quickly made their way back to the fire, policed up the fallen weapons, and exited out the rear of the little complex. As they moved toward the tree line, Mike keyed his radio.
"Coming out,"
he called to Reggie, who replied with a single click. Reggie fell in behind them, and the three made their way toward the trail Sarge and the others would be coming back on. Picking out a spot on the side of the trail, they took up positions and waited. We rode out of the woods and onto the road, hauled ass down the pavement to the intersection with 445, and made the left onto it for the short distance to the trail. Once we were back in the trail, I heard Sarge call Ted on the radio, telling him we were close. They were ready. Through the goggles, I saw the UV laser Ted flashed to show their position, and soon we were stopped while they loaded up. The rest of the trip was uneventful, and we were soon home. We went back to Reggie's house for a quick chat. Sarge and the guys were going to stay there that night, but the next day, he wanted me to show him the place I had mentioned. He told all of us that we needed to start thinking about bugging out. He said the neighborhood wasn't defensible, and things were going to get rough soon. Danny wasn't happy with the thought of leaving his house, and neither was I, but he had a point. I went home and found the house quiet. Mel was sitting on the couch staring at the fire that crackled in the fireplace. When I went to sit down with her, she moved her pistol off the cushion. "You hungry?" she asked. I shook my head.
"No, thanks, though. I'm tired."
"What's wrong?" I looked at her with a half smile.
"What isn't?"
Her reply was to lean over and kiss me, and then she stood up and grabbed my hand. "Come on, let's go to bed. It'll be all right in the morning." We went to our room, and I started pulling off all the gear. Vest, holster, the carbine, and deposited it beside the bed. Then just fell into it. I really wanted to clean up, but didn't feel like taking a cold-ass shower at the moment. I woke up and bolted upright in the bed, my heart pounding in my ears. If I had been dreaming, I didn't remember it, but I was damn sure rattled by something. I sat there in the dark, listening for a minute. Everything seemed fine, but I swung my legs out of the bed and pulled my pants on. After picking up the carbine, I slipped my feet into some Crocs and went out to the living room. Everything was quiet, and I went and checked on the girls. After making sure they were okay, I went out to the front door and stood on the porch, looking at the blackness and listening to the stillness. There wasn't anything out there, but I still felt weird. I went back in the house and grabbed my coat, then walked out to the gate. It was quiet, and I didn't see anything. About halfway to the gate, the dogs came trotting up, yawning and looking sleepy. I figured if they were sleeping and nothing was bothering them, I should go back to bed. As I walked back to the house with the dogs in tow, a string of far-off shots broke the silence, 5 or 6 full auto rounds ripping into the night. In the old days, it was nothing to hear. A few rounds popped off. Didn't even warrant a second thought, but things were different now, and I wasn't going to go wandering around in the dark looking into it. I went inside, locked the door, checked on the girls, and went back to bed. I slept through the night without any more disturbances, and woke up feeling good. Knowing I was going to meet with the guys that morning, I decided to make some breakfast for everyone. I set a bunch of eggs out and lit the old butterfly, then headed out to the shop for a can of the red feather cheese. I grabbed one of the last 2 canned hams I had and headed for the house. The stove was ready, and I set the 12-inch cast iron skillet out, then poured in a little oil. After cracking the eggs, chopping the ham, and shredding the cheese, I poured the eggs into the skillet and stirred them around until they firmed up, then added the cheese and ham. I took the pan from the heat, set it aside, and replaced it with our small, flat skillet. Since things had gone south, Mel had been keeping fresh tortillas in the fridge. She made them every couple of days as needed. Taking the stack from the fridge, I heated them one at a time on the skillet, and then filled and rolled them. When I was done, I had about 12 burritos. I thought about making coffee, but knew Sarge would certainly have some ready when I got there. I felt kind of bad about not leaving any of the burritos for Mel and the girls, but there was plenty for them to eat, even if it was only oatmeal. I put the burritos in a plastic grocery bag and went to tell Mel goodbye. She was still in bed, and she let out a little sound, half groan, half sigh, when I put my arm over her, pushed my face into her back, and held her for a minute. "What are you doing today?" she asked, without rolling over. "We're going to look at the cabins on the Alexander Run. We might have to move there." She rolled over now, far more awake. "Move there? Why would we need to move there? Things are going to get a little more dangerous around here. We did something last night that's going to stir up some shit. I don't want to leave here. As bad as things are, at least we still have our home. How do you think the girls would take it?" I rolled away from her, putting my feet on the floor. "We may not have a choice. As bad as things are, they might get a lot worse." Mel sat up on her left elbow, looking at me. "Well, I don't want to leave unless we have to. And I mean really have to." "I got it. I'll see you later. What are you and the girls going to do today?" "We're going to rake pine needles from the driveway and use them to replace the hay on the floor of the porch. The chickens have made a mess of it, and it needs done," Mel said as she sat up. "Good idea. I'll be back as soon as I can. Love you." "Love you too." After strapping on all my hardware and grabbing my sack of burritos, I headed out for the Polaris. As soon as I came out, the dogs were on me, or at least they were on the bag of breakfast. They followed me to the ATV and sniffed around as I climbed on. They followed me to the gate, and I had to lock them in to keep them from following me to Reggie's. I found all the guys sitting on and around the picnic table behind Reggie's house. Sarge and a couple of others had coffee, though I didn't know how much longer that was going to last. My stock was down to 2 cans. The burritos really got them excited. "Hot damn, breakfast! We were just talking about shooting one of the hogs and dressing it out just to have something to eat," Sarge said, then stuffed the end of a burrito in his mouth. We had our breakfast, and then it was time to get down to business. Sarge wanted to take his 2 buggies to go recon the cabins. Since there were 8 of us, he wanted 4 of us to go and 4 to stay. If he had his way, the 4 who stayed would start packing up and getting ready to move. But Danny and I held our ground about not wanting to bail out of our houses so quick. Sarge let it die for the moment, and then went about making assignments. Mike, Ted, he and I were to go on the recon. The rest of the guys were going to hang out and keep an eye on things. I pointed out the general area of the cabins on Sarge's map. He said, "Looks like a good spot. Having the creek there behind it helps with defense, not to mention having water right at the back door.
Yeah, it's a nice creek too. Good clear water and lots of fish.
Let's go look at the place then. We took off toward the back of the neighborhood and picked up the trail out into the forest. Sarge and I led the way. He had his boot up on the dash. He looked relaxed with the saw swinging from the loose grip of his right hand. Our route to the cabins on the creek would take us past a small neighborhood, a collection of houses out in the forest, which made me wonder how those folks were doing. The only real issue they would have was water. The creek was about a mile from them, and it would be a long walk to haul water. I said, "We have to pass some houses up here in a bit. Don't know if there's anyone there or not, or how they are going to react at seeing us. Is there a way around them, or do we need to go through them? We'll be on a dirt road that runs past them. We could go through the forest around them if we need to. Let's see what it looks like when we get close to them. If the road is blocked or looks hinky, we'll go around." The trip through the forest was uneventful. We didn't see anyone. We picked up the dirt road that would run us past the houses, and I told Sarge to keep his eyes open. He nodded, and we kept going. Sarge called Ted on the radio and told him to keep his eyes open, too. Mike was driving the second buggy, and Ted was on the saw, mounted to the passenger side. It didn't take long to find out if there was anyone around. We came across three of the residents walking down the road. Sarge and I saw them at the same time. He sat up in the seat and kept an eye on them as we approached. Hearing us close on them, the three turned and stood on the edge of the road looking at us. They were all young guys, mid-teens from the look of them. Each of them had a rifle of some sort, and one of them was holding three or four limrats by the tail. I slowed as we came abreast of them, and they stood there looking at us, and at one another, nervously. Sarge leaned back in the seat, putting a boot back up on the dash. Sarge stretched an arm out and rested it on his knee.
"Looks like you boys had some luck," he said.
I was sure if he hadn't broken the ice, the three of them would have stood there forever. The one holding the squirrels raised them a little, looking at them.
"A little. Three-limb rats don't go far, though."
"Y'all live around here?" I asked. The one that answered had long blonde hair sticking out the bottom of a knit watch cap and a skull and crossbones embroidered on it.
"Yeah, but most everyone has left. There's only a few of us left now," he replied, and wiped his nose on the sleeve of his hoodie. "Where'd they go?" Sarge asked.
"Some of them went to stay with family. Some went to the camp over there at the range,"
Snotnose said.
"Are your folks still around?"
Sarge asked. The one holding the squirrels answered,
"Yeah, they're back of the house."
"Can we meet them?"
Sarge asked. The same one asked,
"You guys with the government?"
Sarge chuckled.
"Nah, son, we ain't with the government, I promise you that."
"Well, that's good. Wouldn't be good to meet my old man if you was.
If y'all want to hop in, we'll give you a lift home and meet your folks," Sarge said.
The boys hesitated for a moment. Then, with a shrug, they got in. The blonde-headed one gave directions to their house. It was only one turn off the main dirt road onto a smaller, secondary dirt road. After turning off onto the side road, we started to see people through windows and heads poking through open doors. In front of the kid's house, a big burly man stepped out of a tidy double-wide, sporting a real tree camoed shotgun. He stood there, taking in the scene, as the boys climbed out of the buggy. His eyes shifted from Sarge and me to Mike and Ted, back and forth. He didn't say anything, just stood there, looking with the butt of the turkey gun resting on his hip. The boy that had the squirrels walked onto the porch and spoke quietly to him. What I didn't see was the other men who were coming up the drive. Mike and Ted did, and Mike let us know quietly over the radio. Seeing his backup arrive, the big man finally spoke.
"What can I do for you fellas?"
Sarge stepped out of the buggy, leaving the saw in its mount. The man on the porch shifted the shotgun to a low-ready position. Sarge said,
"Easy there, friend. We don't mean no harm. Just saw your boys walking down the road and gave them a lift is all."
The man moved his head in a barely perceptible nod.
Appreciate it. Anything else?
No, nothing else. They said a bunch of the folks around here have packed up and left. Why'd you stay?
We can take care of ourselves.
We don't need no help from no one.
The ones that left needed to go.
He went on to tell his opinion of people who depended on the government for anything, and it wasn't very flattering. Once he was on that train of thought, he seemed to open up a bit and relax. Sarge asked how they were holding up, and he said that it wasn't easy, but they were getting by hunting the woods and making the occasional trip down to the creek for some fishing. They were managing to get what they needed. Sarge asked him about how many other people were around, and the man pointed to the 5 men standing behind us at the edge of his driveway. Aside from them, there was only a couple of others. Sarge asked him about what the feds were up to around the area. The man said that they had come out once, about a week ago, and offered people to go to the camp. That was when a bunch of folks left, and they didn't know what happened to them after that. He knew it was at the old bombing range, but it was too far to walk, unless it was a one-way trip, and he wasn't going to do that. He asked what we are doing out in the woods, and Sarge told him we are out looking around. It was hard to tell if he believed us or not. Sarge asked him if he was in desperate need of anything.
We could use a doctor. One of the young is sick. Bad water, I think, the man said.
Tell you what, we're going to go down the road here for a bit, then head back. Tomorrow, we'll bring a doc by, and he can take a look at your little one.
We'd appreciate it. I'm getting pretty worried about her.
We said goodbye to them and backed out of the drive. The man standing behind us parted, letting us through. We drove the half mile down the road to the intersection with the forest road that headed for the creek. The small road to the cabins had seen better days. From the looks of it, during the rainy season, the locals had used it for playing with their 4x4s. The road was badly rutted, but the good thing about it was that it looked as though no one had been down it. We slowly bounced down the road to the cabins and pulled up to the little gate at the first one. The gate was made from pipe, a small piece of chain on the end, and a padlock secured it to a post. Climbing out, Sarge reached into the bed of the buggy and pulled out a pair of bolt cutters and had the lock off in no time. We walked up to the little cabin. It wasn't very fancy, basically, just a plywood shack. The door and all the windows had padlocks securing them as well. Sarge handed the bolt cutters to Mike. Mike took the big cutters and stepped toward the door.
The last one wear you out?
What's wrong? Didn't take your fiber this morning? Sarge's reply was a swift kick to Mike's ass, to which he responded with a, "Hey!" while rubbing his cheek.
You'll learn to keep your mouth shut one of these days, Sarge replied.
No, he won't, Ted said, and we all laughed. Mike cut the lock off, opened the door of the little cabin, and stepped in, using his weapon light to illuminate the interior. Ted stood at the door where he could see the buggies outside, while the rest of us went in. There was nothing inside. It was one large room, with a counter running along the full length of the back wall. All the windows had screens over them, with plywood covers over them, outside. These were secured with the padlocks, and could be raised and propped up to allow airflow in the summer, though at the moment, keeping the inside cool was the least of our worries. Heating these things would be the real issue. Looking at the place, I was already thinking of how I could put my wood stove in, and I had 2 kerosene heaters as well. Between these, we could heat all of them. The kerosene would run out eventually, but we could get through the winter with them, that winter, at least. After looking around the inside, we went out to look at the creek, the source of which was the Alexander Spring, about a mile upriver. The water there would be clean and safe, as there were no people in the area to foul it. The run behind the cabin was also full of fish and gators. Large schools of freshwater mullet swam the creek and could easily be netted. Sarge said, "We need to get some boats."
"We have them," I said.
"What have you got?"
"Between Danny and me, we have 4 kayaks, plus Danny has a canoe, and Reggie has one, too."
"Perfect. They'll be real handy. I think this would be a good place to relocate to for a while. I know you guys don't want to, but there's a lot more resources here, and it'll be safer."
"Yes, Sarge.
It's just like your poacher's cabin on the river, Mike said. Sarge just shook his head.
Teddy!
Ted kicked Mike in the ass, and Mike spun around.
What the hell, man?
Ted just shrugged his shoulders. I said, there's only three of these things. There's too many of us. I mean, I have five people, and there's Danny and his wife, Reggie, Thad, Jeff, and you guys. Where's everyone going to stay? You and your family take one. Danny and his wife can take one. The rest of us will use the third. You gotta remember that we won't all be inside here at the same time. There's gonna be plenty of work and security to pull, so it ain't gonna be too bad, Sarge said. I guess we'll make it work if you think we need to move. I know my girls aren't going to be happy about it.
They might not be happy, but they'll be alive, Sarge replied flatly.
Chapter 38. We returned home the way we came, and the whole time I thought about moving. How we would even get everything moved. What we would take. It was a lot to take in. It wasn't like packing a U-Haul in the good old days. Trying to move everyone, with just the Suburban, some four-wheelers, and Sarge's little battle wagons, would take a bunch of trips, not to mention fuel, of which there was precious little. We made it back to the neighborhood without seeing anyone, for which I was very thankful. There had been too much killing, too much shit for my taste. I was no soldier, no warrior, just a dad and a husband, and that's all I wanted to be. We went back to Reggie's house and had a short meeting. Danny, Doc, Jeff, and the rest of us stood around the old picnic table, shooting the shit for a minute. There was little talk about the night before, though Mike and Ted did give a quick rundown on their assault on the trailers. I wasn't too interested in the details. The talk finally got around to what was next, and Sarge suggested we start the move the next day. Danny was on board with that, and I half-heartedly backed him up. Sarge let the issue drop without saying anything, and moved on to his next plan. I want to go out and take a look at the camp over at the range, and we'll need to do it during the day, Sarge said. How you want to go about it? Jeff asked. We need to be careful with this. I'll leave the operational things up to Ted and Mike. How do y'all want to go about it? Sarge asked. Mike and Ted shared a glance. Then Ted spoke. I think we need to take both battle buggies and two four-wheelers as outriders. When we get to the range, we'll need at least two to stay with the machines as backup for those going to take a look. We need to have a saw on each buggy, and those going in need to take Sarge's SPW. The talk went on around the table for a while, until a plan was ironed out. We would go out before daylight tomorrow. We weren't sure where to get a look, as there was a fence all the way around the range, and some thick brush between the fence and the actual range. There were two entrances, one on the east side, one on the west. I didn't think we would be welcomed at either one, so we were going to have to find a way in. Sarge passed out MREs to everyone for dinner. Danny and I both took a pass, as I knew there would be something at home. I told Danny to bring Bobby down, and we would talk while we had dinner together. With that, we told Sarge and the guys we would be back in the morning. He wanted us back at 3:30. I rolled my eyes at him, and he just shook his head and said, "Pussy." I smiled at him and got on the Polaris and headed home. Mel had made a shepherd's pie for dinner, using ground venison and instant potatoes. Thankfully, the pan was big enough for everyone. Mel came into the living room and gave me a kiss and a hug, then commented on my need for a shower. I hadn't taken one that morning, and I knew I needed to. So I told her I would go freeze my ass off and get cleaned up. She was happy when I told her Danny and Bobby were coming down for dinner, as she hadn't seen anyone but the girls in days. The water was cold, and made for a quick shower. Getting out, drying off, and putting on some clean clothes felt so damn good. After pulling on some clean socks, I walked out to the kitchen to find the girls still at the table. It was nice to sit with them and talk. A brief moment of normal. The girls were playing a round of tic-tac-toe, and I got in on it with them, passing the paper back and forth, laughing at one another as we took turns. The dogs barking outside announced that Danny and Bobby were there, and soon they were knocking at the door. Since the girls had already eaten, we shooed them away from the table so we could sit together. They went into the living room and messed around on Jeff's iPad, and I felt even more respect for him realizing that he had never asked for it back. We ate our dinner and talked amongst ourselves. The talk finally got around to the move. Danny brought it up when he asked about the cabins. I told him what they were like, and the girls were immediately against it. Mel asked about the chickens and what we would do with them, about bathroom facilities, and how that would be handled. When I told her we would probably have to use an outhouse of some sort, she was really not happy. Danny and I tried to get across to them that we were not convinced yet that we needed to move, but we might have to, and we should start getting ready just in case. The conversation carried on for a while longer about the whys and why nots of moving, until Leanne came back into the kitchen with a Scrabble board in her hands, wanting to play. The rest of the evening was spent playing. Little Bit came in and sat in my lap, and the two older girls joined in the game. The game took an hour or so, and when we finished, it was time to head for bed, as Danny and I needed to get up early. The girls gave hugs and kisses, and Mel and I walked Danny and Bobby out. Mel carried the pan with the leftovers in it out for the dogs, who were very happy. Once they were headed toward the gate, we went back in and started shutting the house down. After tucking the girls into bed and making sure all the doors were locked, Mel and I went to bed. I was leaning my carbine beside the bed when Mel pinched my ass. She was wearing only her bra and panties and quickly dropped those and climbed into bed. "You're clean enough now," she said as she patted the bed. I smiled at her and turned off the light. I hadn't told Mel what we were doing, so when I got up at 3, she was curious. I told her we were going to check something out and I would be back soon. She told me to hurry, because the girls wanted to spend some time with me, pointing out that I had been absent a lot recently. I told her I would try and kissed her, collected my gear, and headed out. Danny was already at Reggie's when I got there, and the rest of the guys were milling about, getting gear ready and loading the machines. Reggie and Jeff volunteered to stay behind and keep an eye on the place. Sarge, Doc, and Thad would ride in Sarge's buggy. Mike and Ted would take the other. Danny and I would be the outriders. We performed a radio check using Sarge's radios and headsets, and then the old man laid out a map, a surprisingly good map, on the picnic table. Using the hybrid satellite map, he picked out the area he wanted us to look at. It was on the north side, and we were on the south side, so we would have to work our way around the range. With our destination selected, Sarge looked to Danny and I for the route in. What he wanted was a path that wouldn't go anywhere near where we were last night. I told him we could use the route I'd walked in on. It would take us to the west of the range and bring us up on the north side. Using my index finger, I traced it out on the map. Sarge nodded his head as I traced the route. He then picked 2 rally points out, one for the ride in, one for while we were there, and then pointed out the route to use on the way back. It would take us to the east, into the forest, before turning south to head home. With the plan laid out and everyone confident in it, we headed for our vehicles. For this trip, Thad was carrying one of the MP5s captured from the Raiders. He had his trusty coach gun with him as well. He was riding the back of Sarge's buggy. The H&K looked ridiculously small in his big hands. Since I knew the route, I once again took the lead. Danny would ride parallel to us, keeping to our east as we moved north. We all had radios and could maintain contact, though it was understood we would keep transmissions to a minimum. The trip to the north side of the range took a couple of hours. Every road we crossed required security precautions to be taken, slowing things down even more. We didn't see anyone on the way, and that surprised me. As we got closer to the range, I got more nervous, remembering the Humvee I had seen at the barricade and what the hippies had told me about the DHS troopers coming out and making sweeps. I remember the kid with the messed up teeth saying if you went along with them, they wouldn't bother you, but if you crossed the line, they'd drop the boot on you. We were almost a mile to the west of the range, moving down small trails that rose and fell, when Sarge called me and told me to stop on the next rise for a piss break. At the crest of the hill, I stopped and climbed off the Polaris. The 2 buggies soon pulled up, and shortly after, Danny came out of the woods as well. Sarge used the brake to give a few last-minute instructions.
We would leave the rides on that side of the road that ring the range and go in on foot. Two men would stay with them, and the rest of us would go in. Ted and Doc volunteered to stay behind, and Sarge liked that idea, Doc staying back in case anyone got hurt. We loaded back up on the rides and headed for the point we would leave them. It didn't take too long, and again Sarge called for a halt. The two buggies each had a saw mounted on them. Mike picked up Sarge's SPW, the shortened version of the same weapon, and slipped the sling over his head. Little was said as we trotted off toward the range, with Sarge in the lead and Danny and I bringing up the rear. At the road that separated us from the range, Sarge paused, taking a knee and checking the road. After a moment, Sarge waved Mike forward, and he sprinted across the road. After another short pause, Mike gave a thumbs up, and one at a time we crossed the road. Once we were on the other side, we immediately set off again. Mike stayed in the lead, working his way toward the fence. Once we were at the fence, a new problem revealed itself. On the inside of the fence and immediately behind it, the ground had been plowed up for about 12 feet and dragged with what was probably a piece of fence weighed down with something. What this did was create a track trap. If anyone walked across it, it would be obvious the ground had been disturbed. This was a problem. The best solution was to wait out the patrols and time them to see if they were regular or random, and then plan an entry. But we didn't have that kind of time. Instead, Sarge positioned Danny at the fence, where he could see down it in either direction for several hundred yards. If he saw an approaching patrol, he was to call it in, and we would bug out. Not the best plan, but all we could do at the moment. Mike cut a small hole in the fence, and we quickly moved through it. The final approach was made much slower. Mike set the pace, and we slowly made our way through the pine brush. Eventually, the trees started to thin, and the camp started to come into view. We spread out in a loose line and crawled up on our stomachs, staying just inside the tree line, but with a full view of the camp from a small sandy hill. What stretched out before us was impressive and intimidating at the same time. Rows and rows of tents, the big military style, ran off for what looked like a mile. There were neatly painted signs that I could read through my binos. They were marked with letters and numbers, and at intersections, there were posts with signs that read medical, mess hall, showers, and latrine. The place was not what I expected. It looked nice. I had been expecting a concentration camp. I told Sarge that. He said, "What do you see down there?" looking through his binos. I scanned the camp again. Tents, people, chow halls, and latrines. Looks like a well-run refugee camp.
That's what I was thinking, Thad said.
I see that too, but there's more, Sarge said.
I scanned the camp.
Like what?
You see the yellow tape? Sarge asked.
Yes. Yellow caution tape, like you'd seen on a construction site, ran down the two sides we could see, supported intermittently by 4x4 posts.
See anyone outside the tape?
I scanned the area. Then I saw what Sarge was getting at. There were guard towers at the corners with machine guns mounted in them.
You see across the camp? See those towers? Sarge asked.
I looked across the camp. We could only see the tops of several towers, but coming out from behind a row of tents was a part of a cage made from chain-link fence. It even had a top on it. Inside, I could see two people in orange jumpsuits. They looked like inmates at the county jail.
I guess they probably have some bad apples, Thad said.
I grunted.
All right. Do you see that group of people down there working? The ones with shovels? Sarge asked.
I looked down on the camp and did see a group of people that were filling what looked like sandbags. They worked in twos, one holding a bag, one filling the bag with white sand. Standing around them were several armed men forming a loose ring around them. I still didn't think it was as bad as Sarge was making it out to be. A cloud of dust rose from the front of the camp, and all the people looked toward it, which was what caused me to look that way. A row of 4 white buses came rolling to a stop, escorted by Humvees with gunners and machine guns in their turrets. Hearing faint shouts, I looked back to the group that was working.
The armed men were shouting at them, pointing and running around. The workers went back to their task, though most of those holding the bags kept an eye on the buses. A group of armed men gathered around the buses before the doors opened. The doors soon opened and people began to pour out. The group of armed men, waiting on them, began to drive them toward a fenced area with kicks and shoves. It was obvious the people getting off the bus were disoriented, and that's when I noticed the windows in the buses were blacked out.
"How's that look for friendly?" Sarge asked.
I scanned the camp again, looking back to the group filling bags as shouts drifted across the camp. Two women were working together. An older-looking woman was holding the bag as another filled it. The one filling the bag paused for a moment and looked up toward the woods. She wiped her forehead with the back of her hand, then looked down at her palm and rubbed at it. She turned a bit, and I could see her face. I reached over and hit Thad. He looked at me, and I pointed. "Look at those two women," I said.
"Where?"
Thad asked, looking at the group. "On the right side. She's looking this way. See her?" Thad stared through the binos for a second.
"Yeah, I do."
The radio cracked. "There's a truck in the fence line," Danny called.
"Let's go! Move! Now!" Sarge barked.
We crawled back from the trees and rose to a crouch and began to sprint back to the hole in the fence. Sarge called Danny asking for an update. He told us to hold inside the trees. There was a small hill the truck would start down in a moment, and we would be able to cross without being seen. Mike was kneeling at the edge of the drag. The SPW pointed down the fence.
"Move! Move now!" Danny called.
We sprinted across the drag and pulled ourselves through the fence. It seemed to take forever, with mag pouches hanging up and other things snagging. As soon as we cleared the fence, we all started moving toward the road in a sprint. Mike hit the road first and took a knee, scanning the road. Once everyone was at the road, Mike sprinted across and I followed him. Just as I cleared the road, Thad started across. He was at a full run in the center of the road when a Humvee rounded the corner fewer than 100 yards from him. The truck gunned its engine, and even over the sound of the diesel, I heard the gunner yell,
"Contact front!"
And then his machine gun opened up. The driver drove hard and fast and was between our two groups in a flash. Mike immediately opened up on the truck. We gave them fire from both sides of the road, and the driver began to back out as the gunner shouted. Mike was screaming for us to move, and in the radio, I could hear Sarge say he was moving south to cross the road. The firing let up on his side, and they started to move. Mike called out,
"Reloading!"
And suddenly, it was real quiet, with only Thad firing. I hadn't even pulled the trigger. The Humvee roared its engine again, and the gunner brought his weapon to bear on our side of the road. The amount of lead slapping into the trees around us forced the three of us onto the ground. Leaves, pine needles, and debris fell on us like a storm. The sound of all those bullets cracking over our heads was terrifying. Mike was screaming into his radio, and suddenly Ted appeared, standing over me. He fired the saw from his shoulder in long bursts, and brass spewed from the hot weapon down around me. He let off the trigger for a second, looked down at me, and screamed,
"Get up! Get up and fire your goddamn weapon!"
Then brass was pouring from the weapon again, a constant flame erupting from the muzzle. Mike had his weapon reloaded and joined in. I pulled myself up and flipped the carbine to fire and began firing at the windshield of the now-retreating truck. On my radio, I heard Sarge call out,
"Let's go, damn it! Get your asses to the buggies!"
Ted called out,
"Reloading!"
Then looked at me,
"Go, go, go, go!"
Thad was just as wide-eyed as I was. The two of us took off at a run toward the machines. We broke out of the trees to find Sarge and Danny already there. Somehow, they had crossed the road and made it there before we did. In a flash, Mike and Ted were there as well. Everyone mounted their machines, and Sarge called out for us to follow him. He took off, wide open to the north, with Danny and me behind him, and Mike and Ted bringing up the rear this time. We ran hard and fast, not knowing if that had a reaction force in the way or not. Any minute I expected to see a helicopter overhead, but we were moving too fast to be too worried about it. We ran north, almost to Highway 40, then turned east, going as fast as we could on open trails. Without slowing or waiting, Sarge crossed over Highway 19 with the rest of us, hot on his tail. As I crossed the road, I looked both ways real quick and was relieved beyond words not to see anything. We were on the back side of Grasshopper Lake, a good 6 miles from where the shootout happened, when Sarge stopped. Ted and Mike pulled up beside him and were talking. I pulled up on the other side of them and stopped beside Thad in the rear. I looked in at him and said, "Dude, was that Jess?" Epilogue. Jess grounded the tip of her shovel in the dirt and looked over at the buses that had just arrived. Mary hissed, "Come on, we gotta meet our quota." She held out the sandbag she and Jess were filling. One of the DHS goons barked, "It's not break time, keep working," and Jess went back to digging. After the raiders had hit her neighborhood and killed her parents, she had been happy to get on the bus to the FEMA camp. There was nothing left at home. No family, no food, no hope. But at the camp, things didn't turn out the way the black uniformed men had promised. Families were split up, malcontents were beaten or disappeared, and there was no going outside the fence. After a week of denial, Jess understood that she had volunteered for a prison sentence. A week after that, she thought something different. It wasn't a prison. It was a concentration camp. People she had met who couldn't keep their opinions to themselves, libertarians, old-school liberals, Reagan conservatives, became scarcer and scarcer. And rumor had it that on the other side of the detainment area was a series of trenches dug by bulldozers. People pointed out that the detainees, what the DHS goons called the resistors, never seemed to increase in numbers. You could see them through the chain link, but no one was allowed close enough to talk to them. Mary asked her the question that got her thinking. "We see them arrest people every day and send them to detention. So if there's more people going into detention all the time, how come it's always the same number of people you can see through the fence?" Mary was black, and she followed that question with another one. "You've seen how many black people get off those buses. So where are they? How many black people you know in this place?" "Just you," Jess said. "Right, just me. And how many black people do you see in the detention yard? Not so many, right?" Jess's stomach had done a flip. She knew where this was going, and she suddenly knew she had known it for a week without admitting it to herself. "Yeah, not so many," she said. Mary said, "I was a math teacher, but anyone can work those numbers." Jess said, "Maybe they're sending them to different camps." Mary snorted scornfully. "Sure. Maybe they're putting all the black folk in another camp. What's that sound like to you? But if they're doing that, how come we never see lines of black people being loaded onto buses? I'll tell you why. This place is a DHS roach motel. Blacks check in, but they don't check out. And it ain't just black people. We're just easier to notice. It's the ACLU and Second Amendment people, too. Anyone that doesn't have the sense to toe the line. Anyone that's not going to be a good citizen of the new America." Jess wondered how it had gotten this bad this quickly. Wasn't anyone standing up to the government? But she knew the answer. And it was the same answer to the question people had been asking for 70 years. Why did the average German go along with Hitler? And the sad thing, Jess thought, was that it was the same stupid answer that every teenager gave when they got caught doing something stupid. It seemed like a good idea at the time. She thought about Morgan and Thad and hoped to God they were okay. She knew they'd never agree to take their families into one of the camps. But she knew, too, that meant they were probably dead. This is Duke Fontaine. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Surviving Home.
This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Dion Audio. Surviving Home is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group, USA, LLC, a Penguin Random House company. Copyright 2013. All rights reserved. The book, Surviving Home, is available wherever Plume books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.